Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast number 17. My name's Terry Frost, and this time around we are looking at two movies based on the works of science fiction writers. The first one's going to be the 1992 science fiction film Timescape with Jeff Daniels, and the second one is an old childhood favourite of almost everybody, The Invisible Boy from 1957, starring, most of all, Robbie the Robot. So sit back and we'll have some fun. The Martian Drive-In Podcast is a full weekly podcast of speculative fiction, fantasy and horror movie appreciation. Whether it's English language or non-English language, whether it's old or new, it doesn't really matter. As long as it's good stuff and possibly a little bit obscure and off most people's radar. Now you can contact me via my email address, cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can go to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on the Book of Phases. And also you can contact me via the voicemail line, 206-338-9397. There may be adult content in this podcast, so if you're easily offended, why are you listening to podcasts? Bonjour or bonsoir, je m'appelle Terry Frost. No, well, actually, I've been doing my French lesson courses on Duolingo.com, so I'm doing half an hour of that every day, and I've got a lot of French in my head, so if I occasionally come out with odd words, I do apologize for this podcast. Hope everybody is doing fine. It's still winter here, which sucks a lot, though I have been looking at a couple of webcams in the Northern Hemisphere, and I believe that there's a very, very nice little swimming pool at the North Pole at the moment, which is a bit worrisome, and it's really science fiction-y to find a pool of melted ice, at the North Pole. If you go to the North Pole webcam, and that's pretty easy to find on a Google search, you'll see it, and it's quite disturbing. Now, it's not really going to happen at the South Pole, because you've got an entire continent and about 6 kilometres of ice above that continent in the South Pole, but the North Pole, being as it is a bunch of islands surrounded by and covered by ice, doesn't really have the same durability, perhaps. Though, of course, we do have the problems of having those great, enormous, kilometre-deep ice sheets tumbling into the Southern Ocean and causing all sorts of chaos. So it is a very science fiction world that we live in, and disturbingly so. Remember back when you were a kid and science fiction was all about the groovy stuff that was going to happen, apart from the nuclear annihilation thing, which you can discount because it would have, as Frank Zappa said, affected real estate values. But there's some creepy aspects to living in a science fictional future. And that webcam picture of the North Pole is just one of them. And on that cheerful note, I'm going to continue. I'll just let you know what I've been watching. I did see Pacific Rim. And yes, the guys doing the Australian accents didn't quite get it right. I'm not sure why they didn't get Australian actors to do the job. There are a number of them available, and some of whom are very good and are looking for work. So I'm not sure where Guillermo del Toro was coming from on that. It's a little bit Dick Van Dyke in Mary Poppins for my tastes, and it's part of an overwhelming cultural cringe bugbear of mine. Things like the fact that Mad Max is now going to be played by an Englishman and set in South Africa. That kind of stuff. Cultural imperialism, and it's just not good enough, and people should write to their government representatives and complain about it. So, having said that rant, apart from that, I did enjoy Pacific Rim a lot. The kaiju were great, though. They did tend to have a lot of Cloverfield about them. The Jaegers, the giant mecha, were really, really good. Skyscraper tall robots are always a lot of fun. And one of the things that the effects guys did really, really well is give a sense of the physics of these enormous creatures and robots fighting against each other. There's a palpable sense of mass about them when they throw each other around Hong Kong and the ocean and under the ocean and up in the sky and all sorts of other places like that. The human story kind of balances it well. The actors aren't particularly well known apart from a couple like Idris Elba and Ron Perlman, who has his own little moment, not reminiscent of Samuel L. Jackson in a movie of about a dozen years ago. But having said that, it's a lot of fun. I'm sure it's going to be the start of at least a two-movie franchise. Didn't do terribly well in the US box office on the opening weekend, but it did incredibly well when it reached overseas markets, including Australia. It's done very well in Australia. And I do know a lot of kaiju fans out there who really do get their squee on with this sort of film. And I've also seen a little bit of the stuff from the new Godzilla movie, which I think they may be doing right. Godzilla does look like Godzilla, and an interesting little experiment. Whether it's going to be as successful as the earlier Godzilla franchise, of course, it's going to be more successful than the 1998 one, which even Jean Reno couldn't save. But it'll be interesting to see what happens with that. So let's see what else in the speculative fiction realm I've been watching. Just going to crank up the Mizo. Let me see, Pacific Rim, I've talked about that. I did see one of the DC animations, which I kind of liked. Justice League, The Flashpoint Paradox, which centers around the Flash and his life and his troubles and all sorts of other things. And it's really a nice piece of work. These DC animations are really good stuff. And even though they're not kind of CGI'd and they're classic animation, I think they work really well. The voice talent they've got is excellent. They're willing to go pretty gritty with it. And it's quite an enjoyable way to spend a little bit of time if you do get a chance to. I did see a few other things. On Bastille Day on the 14th of July, I did have a French film festival at home. I did see four movies. I saw Leon, The Professional. I saw Viva Sa Vie, which is a Godard movie starring his one-time wife, Anna Karina. I did also see Band of Outsiders, another Godard movie starring Anna Karina. And I did see a speculative fiction movie from not too long ago called The Horde, which is a Paris-based zombie movie. And it kicks ass. It's tough. It's got lots of really nice little set pieces. And there's not a character in them who's nice, which is always good. They're not poor little innocent American teenagers running away from zombies. These are hardened cops and crims in a semi-abandoned apartment block, not unlike the Raid Redemption. Imagine the Raid Redemption played with French and African actors, full of zombies. It's a lot like that, and it's a lot of fun. I believe there is a sequel, which I'm going to have to track down. But The Horde worked really well, and it's also really good if you ever want to learn to swear in French. It's this sort of movie that you need to see. The swear words in it are quite graphic, which is always a lot of fun. And just as a shout-out to my mate Dave Sofinger, I do have to mention that Sal and I did see Sharknado. And yes, it's incredibly silly. It's an asylum movie, so the budget was like $27.30. But it's got an audacity which is kind of fun. It's low rent, low budget, but tongue very much in cheek. And I'm not surprised that it's got a little bit of a viral cult following. And a lot of people are really grooving on it. It's silly and dumb and outrageous and incredibly unlikely, but it's got its own kind of fun about it, which I kind of appreciated. I think if you can't appreciate a dumb fun movie now and then, you really do need to have someone change your medication a bit. Having said that, I'm going to take a break, and then I'm going to talk about the first of the two movies. I think I'll do Timescape from 1992. It's based on a novella by Henry Cutner and C.L. Moore, mostly by C.L. Moore from what I can ascertain, and it's an interesting little piece of work. One of the things that triggered the memory of this movie in me was watching Jeff Daniels in The Newsroom, which is Aaron Sorkin's latest TV series, and I've got a few problems with it, but I still kind of get sucked into the Sorkinese talk and the story arc and the characters in spite of the fact that it doesn't really do the Bechdel test very well. Characters of any ethnicity are marginalised in it, and the female characters are all a bit ditzy. But having said that, I still get sucked into Aaron Sorkin TV shows. But leaving that aside, Jeff Daniels, fine actor. If you ever saw him in Gettysburg, for instance, tremendously powerful actor when he wants to be. People know him most from things like Dumb and Dumber. But he really does have solid chops as an actor, and this movie does demonstrate that a fair bit. The movie is based on a 1946 novella written by C.L. Moore and Henry Kuttner, writing as Lawrence O'Donnell, which was one of the names they used when they collaborated. They were married, and as I said earlier, for the most part, this is C.L. Moore's work. Catherine L. Moore, she wrote as C.L. Moore because people were a bit iffy in the pulp days of science fiction, and this appeared in Astounding Science Fiction in September 46. In those days, women writing science fiction wasn't as common or as ubiquitous even as it is now. And so she, in order to maximize her the possibility of getting published, she used a kind of gender-neutral pseudonym. She lived from 1911 to 1987 and is kind of one of those really good early female science fiction writers. Her story Shamblo, which is in her Northwest Smith series, set on a kind of Wild West Mars, is one of the classics of the genre. If you haven't read that one, you really should. It's got a creepy science fantasy vibe about it that really is great. There was a sequel written to the story as well, to Vintage Season. Robert Silverberg, another great science fiction writer, did write a sequel to this, which was published with the original in a tour double in 1990. It's called In Another Country. I've got the tour double here somewhere in the massive slabs of books I've got that I haven't sorted yet. But it really is a little bit of an unusual science fiction story, in a sense. And it does bring up some interesting issues, even back from 1946, about the ethics of time travelling in a way that hadn't been done before and hasn't been done enough since. Really, how ethical is it to go back into the past and change history, for instance? What are the moral implications of that kind of stuff? Or even of going back to see interesting events? And that's at the core of this story. Is it a moral act to be a tourist in some pretty horrendous historic events? And before I go further, I should tell you that if you go to marsdrivein.blogspot.com, thanks to the nice people over at YouTube, you can watch both of the movies I'm talking about today, full film, on YouTube. So if you've got one of those snazzy new TVs that automatically hooks up to YouTube and then wipes your nose, jerks you off, and makes you a cup of coffee, you can do that. Or else, if you're like me, and you know ways to rip audio from YouTube, you can do so and enjoy the movies whenever you like. There are a lot of full feature films coming up on YouTube at the moment, and it is worth your time. If you're looking for something a bit obscure, just type it into the search box and see whether it's there. I don't know for how long a lot of these movies are going to remain there when the copyright owners find out about them, but at the moment they are freely available, and they do have a really eclectic and interesting range of films showing up on that particular platform. So I'm not encouraging anybody to steal, not encouraging anybody to put on an eye patch, a hook, and go and pirate anything. I'm saying it's there, and I have embedded it into the marsdrivein.blogspot.com webpage so that you can look at it. So if you're worried about spoilers on these two films, what I suggest is take a break now. Go and watch the two movies through the marsdrivein.blogspot.com webpage, and then come back and we can have a talk about them. Because I will be doing spoilers on both of them, because the most interesting parts of the movies are in the spoilers. And so that's how I'm going to have to run this at the moment, because of the nature of the films. Avoiding spoilers cripples your ability to talk about them. In the movie, Jeff Daniels plays a guy called Ben Wilson, who's a widower who was haunted by the death of his wife. There was a car accident in the snow, and his wife died in pretty horrendous circumstances. And he had a certain reaction to that at the time, which has left him kind of marginalized. He owns a big old house on a hill outside a small country town, lives there with his daughter, and is a kind of borderline alcoholic at the time. His father-in-law, who happens to be a judge in the town, played very characteristically by a fine character actor called George Murdoch, plays Judge Caldwell, is trying to get custody of Ben's daughter, Hillary, played by Ariana Richards, who was one of the kids in Jurassic Park. So he's kind of trying to renovate this enormous house and turn it into a bed and breakfast. And he gets approached by a very strange woman who represents a tour group. They say they're from South California rather than Southern California. And they want to rent out some rooms. They offer him a lot of money to do it, and he accepts the money. With them is a bus driver, a local guy whose name is Oscar, who kind of realizes that these people are a bit weird. He's played by an actor called Jim Haney. If you have a look at Jim Haney's IMDb, he's been in a ton of stuff. But both Oscar and Ben realize that these people are pretty weird. Now, one of the tour group arrives late, and he's covered in ash. His suit is just covered in fine gray ash, and they don't understand why. Now, this guy's name is Quish, played by David Wells, and he's kind of nervous and edgy. Everybody else in the tour group is beautiful. They're yuppie-looking people. They're metrosexual guys and beautiful women, and they're physically perfect, even if they do have an early 1990s. A couple of the guys have early 1990s mullets and look a little bit like the Eurotrash bad guys in Die Hard on Holiday. Having said that, the group stay in the bed and breakfast and start looking at the windows, and there's something very odd about them. Now, Quish, the latecomer in the group, has a little bit of a car accident and needs to get an x-ray. They're not sure he's concussed or not, and the local doctor does an x-ray. And they find out he's actually got machines, little camera things behind his eyes. And slowly Ben and Oscar come to the realization that these people are time travelers who have come to the little town, but they don't know why. Now, here's where the spoilers start. They're there because something catastrophic is going to happen to the town. And they're there to kind of watch it as disaster tourists, in a sense. We're getting a little bit of that now in real life, but these are time-traveling disaster tourists who come through various places. Eventually, Ben and Oscar find out that they've been to the San Francisco earthquake in 1906. They've been to Mount St. Helens in 1980, hence Quish being covered in ash. And they've come to 1992 in this little town because there's a meteor strike on the edge of town, which is going to blast away half of the town. It's very spectacular. It's very catastrophic. And then there's a secondary disaster in one of the emergency housing places where a furnace blows up and kills more people than the original meteor strike does. And Ben loses his daughter in that second explosion when it happens. And he confirms that these people are actual time travelers. And then at the heart of the film is Ben's love for Hillary and his realization that these people have come back in time and haven't done anything to try to help. I've got some audio from the film here. It runs about 2 minutes or so, but it does get to the core of this film and why I find it really an interesting little, not too large budget, and not particularly well-known effort.
You let my daughter die.
Your daughter perished, but you survived. That much, at least, is as it should be. The rest of this is an unexpected permutation.
This is not as serious as it seems. We've recovered the remains. What other evidence is there? We leave behind only innuendo stories.
Dead bodies. I don't believe this. You could have done something. You watched.
Done something?
Yeah, like warned us.
I'm not going to get into this too deeply with you, Mr. Wilson, but seeing as how you're already contaminated, listen closely and try to understand. We do not alter the past. That would destabilize our timescape, and we won't allow that because...
Because it's a perfect world, right?
Because we enjoy things as they are. Yet we found in early dabbling that time was not the fragile thing that many assumed that it would be. It's quite resilient, really. That's why it is that we can allow these tours, but what we cannot allow is involvement in issues of life and death. Now, these are things that we can only watch as they sort themselves out. You understand?
Is that why you left me in the hotel?
You went there of free will.
You had me drugged to make sure I'd stay there. What was I? Somebody you just did a folk dance with? Maybe I wasn't even that. Maybe I was just some face in some old photograph. Oh, some painting on a museum wall.
No, I never meant to leave you there. I didn't
know. Hey, nobody cares. Nobody cares what happens to us. We're just bygoners, right? Rotting away in our graves before you were even born. Well, let me got news for you. In this timescape, we're alive and you are the ones that are dead. You're dead because you don't feel. You're dead because you're so goddamn bored with your own world that you gotta come to ours to be disaster groupies. Spectacle. You're sad. You're just...
Passports, please. Moving ahead to February 12th, 1999.
Moving on. Now, you must remember that the Mardi Gras fire takes place in New Orleans, so we all have to be up. Yes, a little laughter. Remember now, everyone happy. Good girl. Life is grand. Moving on. Practice.
So that's it. That's the kind of attitude that the people have. Who are these kind of time-traveling disaster tourists. And I just did a little bit of a Wikipedia search while I was listening to that. And disaster tourism is a real thing in our real world too. There was a fair bit of it at Hurricane Katrina, in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, and at the 2010 eruption of that unpronounceable volcano in Iceland. There are a lot of people that showed up at that as well. So it's going to be an ongoing feature of our jet-setting, globe-trotting culture, that we're accessible. People are going to, well, certain kinds of people and certain amounts of them are going to flock to these sort of places to get their Instagram pictures for their Facebook pages and other things like that. So it's kind of consistent with what we know of a certain kind of human nature to do that. And the film is kind of interesting. By the way, the guy talking with Jeff Daniels in that clip was Robert Colbert, who people might remember was one of the two time travelers in the Time Tunnel. So there's a little bit of a nod to that series by having him in there. And he does a kind of good bit of work with it, too. Now, the film was written and directed by David Tui, who people might know from films like Pitch Black and The Chronicles of Riddick and the new Riddick movie coming out. So he's definitely got chops in the genre and has continued on in that. And I do think if you have a look at things like those films that I mentioned, particularly the first Riddick movie, Pitch Black, Tui does know genre pretty well. And he also did an interesting film way back when with Charlie Sheen in it called The Arrival. And that movie was kind of very audacious for its budget and for the, particularly the effects budget. But, Tui does know his stuff pretty well. Let me just see some of the other things that he's done, which are quite interesting. He did a film from around 2001 called Imposter with Gary Sinise, which is another science fiction work based on a Philip K. Dick story, like pretty much every science fiction movie was at one stage. It's got Gary Sinise, Madeline Stowe, Vincent D'Onofrio, Tony Shalhoub, Tim Guiney, Mackay Pfeiffer, a few other people in it. That one's kind of interesting to watch too, and it may turn up in the future Martian Drive-In podcast as well. Tui does good stuff, leaving aside the Chronicles of Riddick, of course, which was a bit of a dog's breakfast, even though Judi Dench was in it for some reason. But I think he's an interesting science fiction film guy. And like people like Vincenzo Natali, he's kind of in that second string of things where he's not as well known as a lot of other people who do genre works. But he's got a keen sense of it. He's got a keen sense of the history of the genre as well. Hence using C.L. Moore, Henry Kuttner novella for Timescape. And I do think he does know genre pretty well. Now, having said all that, and having said how great Jeff Daniels is in this film and that, it's not without its problems. I think the Grace Note ending is kind of soft. And I'm not going to spoil that part because I think it's, it's giving the spoiler. He does rescue his daughter. But there's another Grace Note ending after that, which is kind of, weak. And you can see it as kind of weakening the whole structure of the story in some ways. But having said that, I like 95% of this film. And I really do appreciate that Tui did do it. And the character, Ben, also is an interesting one, too, because of those character flaws and because of the way he reacted at the car accident when his wife died. A very human reaction, but not one you see very much in movies. And again, I'm going to leave that spoiler-free, that minor aspect of it as well. It's a solid B picture in a sense, and it's not a movie that requires an enormous special effects budget. It's not a movie that needs big name stars and all sorts of whiz bang shit like that. But what Tui does is he's got a solid lead character. The people from the future are the sort of people you might see in a post-scarcity world, where all of the people's needs are taken care of, and you know, you can genetically look any way you want to. And it's a kind of decadent future, a decadent, peaceful, utopian future, where to get their kicks, they have to come to a much grittier and nastier place, a bit like people visiting border towns when they live in gated communities, to see something, a kind of uncontrolled reality, in a sense. And that's, I mean, utopia is something that every society in the history of the world, perhaps, with a few exceptions, is shooting for. But as a destination rather than a goal, it can often leave something to be desired. So check that one out. I've made it accessible to you. It's better than 90% of the shit you're going to see out there. And I think it really is a quality piece of work toward the start of the career of somebody who has done some good genre works. Pitch Black is a good blending of hard science and action cinema. And from the, what I can see of the new Riddick movie, it looks like it's got the chops as well. So I'm going to take another break now. When I get back, I'm going to go a little bit lighter here with a little less doom, gloom and death right up to a certain point with the 1957 film The Invisible Boy.
Hammer Film Productions began in 1934, and after producing almost 200 films and television programs, the studio is still releasing and re-releasing new and classic film titles. 1951 Down Place is the podcast that brings you the story of the great Hammer films, one movie at a time. Here are your hosts, describing what Hammer means to them. First is Casey.
Hammer means the beautiful and glamorous women of Hammer horror, the engaging storytelling, and amazing period films.
Joining him is Derek.
Hammer means the incredible work of actors like Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee, and even Michael Ripper. The gothic storytelling, the incredible music, and the set pieces.
And finally, here's Scott.
Hammer, that's vodka and orange juice.
This boy has a lot to learn. Join our hosts as they make their journey through the Hammer Films catalogue and discuss each film with critical opinion, historical facts, production notes, and other information about these classic films. 1951 Downplace can be found in iTunes or their website, www.1951downplace.com.
Wait, that's a screwdriver.
1951 Downplace, the home of Hammer Films discussion.
Here is the breaking news from the planet Mars.
Okay, the news from the planet Mars this time around isn't about the planet Mars directly. It's kind of an indirect thing. What I want to talk about is a game that I played set on the planet Mars. It's called Waking Mars, and it's by Tiger Style Games for the iPad. And basically, you get to play an astronaut on Mars, a guy called Liang, who is sent on a mission to explore some caves under Mars where he finds some Martian life. And the whole point of the game is to spread the Martian life and to balance the ecology of these weird Martian plant animal things. As you do, you get access to more caves and more mysteries are solved. And the interesting thing about this game is that they're trying to base it all on real science. They're not faking it all up and making it up out of their heads. As much as possible, they've consulted with experts and are getting the science right, which is kind of interesting. And you play this little character, Liang, jetpacking around these caves, finding various life forms, some of which are hostile to him, some of which are scared of him, some of which totally ignore him. And he gets to plant seeds that he collects and spread life through the caves underneath Mars. I'm about halfway through the game at the moment, but it's a lot of fun to play. You can restart it at various times and save, and you kind of get different results. As you learn more, it's often better to restart the game, go through it, and put into place what you learn. So that's pretty much the news from the planet Mars. Waking Mars, it's called. You can get it from the iTunes store if you like, and I've had it a lot of fun. It's about $5, I think it was. But it's given me enough entertainment that the $5 price is well worth it. There are no in-game purchases to make, which is a nice change. Give it a go if you're interested in some fun gaming that is based on some hard science.
Can you make a kite?
A kite?
How dumb can you get? Here. This is just a little no good one that my mom got me in the supermarket when my dad kept being too busy.
Master, if you will describe its intended function.
A kite? Well, you fly him. Of course, on a string, you know, up in the air, when the wind blows. Oh, brother.
Aerodynamically unstable.
Can make me a better one. And it has to be a lot bigger than this. A whole lot bigger. Real big.
Okay, that was Robbie the Robot and Richard Iyer from The Invisible Boy. And it just shows, I wanted to play that one because it shows the kid's got attitude. He really is a kid who's a bit wild, and I kind of liked it. I like the fact that he's not a goody-goody kid like he got in things like The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T. So this movie is a kind of sequel to Forbidden Planet, which is odd because Forbidden Planet is set 300 years after the timeline in The Invisible Boy, but that's what makes it interesting. I have a theory about this film, which I'm going to expound during the course of this conversation, that it's kind of really an interesting way, in a really interesting way, it is a sequel to Forbidden Planet. Now, the story is a really kind of odd one in the sense that right up to the last 20 minutes, it plays like a light 1950s science fiction comedy with a child in it. It's got Robbie the Robot, who MGM wanted to make another movie with because the damn thing was so expensive they wanted to get a bit of extra value out of the robot itself. But this one was actually based on a Saturday Evening Post story by an English science fiction writer called Edmund Cooper, who had something of a career in the middle part of the 20th century. He did a few different novels, Transit and Kronk, which was also known as Son of Kronk. He had he did Seed of Light, a few other things. He really had a kind of middling career in the early part of, from the 1950s till the 1980s, writing kind of paperback science fiction in a sense. He started out, he served in the British Merchant Navy in 1944 and 1945 and became an editor and began to publish stories with a genre twist to them. Kind of slightly misogynistic in tone, a lot of the stories, particularly later on. And he was a bit of a doom and gloom guy when it came to nuclear holocaust, which is a kind of feature of a certain kind of science fiction writer at the time. But I do like a number of his stories, and I did read them when I was very much younger. He, under the pseudonym of Richard Avery, he did a series of kind of space opera-y adventures called The Expendables, in the 1980s, which were available on paperback, and I picked up and devoured really cheaply. I think I've still got one somewhere, but my science fiction library is in a state of utter chaos at the moment, so I haven't been able to find it and revisit it. But I think that basis of the Edmund Cooper story, which they drift from a fair bit, gives it an interest, the interesting twist at the tail of this movie. Apart from Robbie the Robot, it stars, as I said, Richard Eyre, a child actor who appeared in a couple of interesting things and then retired from the industry to have a much more fulfilling career as a school teacher, which is all credit to him. He was in The Seven Voyages of Sinbad, for instance. He was in The Desperate Hours with Humphrey Bogart and Frederick March in the 1950s, and then went on to do a little bit of television work in the 60s, but ended up finding that his true passion was elsewhere in the educational field. And from all reports, he was quite successful at that. Now, his father, Dr. Marino, is played by an actor called Philip Abbott, whose face is very familiar to people. He did a whole lot of TV from the 50s on, right on until the 1980s. He did things like Gunsmoke, 77 Sunset Strip. Let's see, The Fugitive, he did an episode of that. He did some TV for Disneyland, Perry Mason. He did star in the FBI TV series from 1965 to 1974, at the tail end of it between 73 and 74. And among his last work, which is kind of interesting, was in 1995, in the Spider-Man animated TV series, he played the voice of Nick Fury. And also in the Nine-Man TV series in 1995, he was the voice of Nick Fury before Nick Fury became an African-American with the Ultimates reboots and things like that. So he died in 1998 at the age of 74, so he had a long and just honoured a career in cinema and in television and as a voice actor as well. It's amazing the actors they find doing voice work these days, really good quality actors who maybe have aged a little bit and can't find decent work, but has still got a lot to offer, which is why things like the DC animation now has such quality voice acting, because these people are available and really do add a lot to that particular genre. As I said with Timescape, the movie is available on YouTube, and there's a link at marsdriving.bullockspot.com. So here's where the spoilers come in, as I describe the plot of the film, which is really interesting, and tonally it varies a lot from the start to the finish. The Wikipedia précis of the film is probably the best one I've got at the moment. It says, "The Invisible Boy is a curious mixture of light-hearted playfulness and menacing evil. As it begins, 10-year-old Timmy Marino, Richard Eyre, seems only to want a playmate. After he is mysteriously invested with superior intelligence, he reassembles a robot that his father and other scientists have been ready to discard as unrepairable junk. No one pays much attention to the robot after Timmy gets it going, until Timmy's mother becomes angry when Timmy is taken aloft on a huge kite that the robot builds. When Timmy expresses a wish to be able to play without being observed by his parents, the robot, with the aid of an evil supercomputer that his father runs, makes him invisible. At first, Timmy uses the invisibility to play simple pranks on his parents and other people, but the mood of the film soon changes when it becomes clear that the supercomputer intends to take over the world through a military satellite." And that's where the tonal shift comes in. It really does go in a strange and dark way. Now, Robbie the Robot itself, the robot has an interesting origin. It was created by a doctor who has since died, who was messing around with a time machine. I'll just play the audio on that, because it's important to what I really like about this film.
Who's Robbie?
Oh, there's nothing much. Sort of a scientific joke the staff used to play around with after hours, based on some of Dr. Greenhill's later work.
Oh, the old gentleman who dropped his marbles.
Mm-hmm. Poor old guy. After he retired as director, he got fooling around with a time machine, some gadget he thought could take him off into the future.
But somebody did go into the future, and and learned something there and then came back out. Wouldn't that change now?
Well, I guess it would at that. Even old Greenhill never thought of that one. These assemblies were devised by Dr. Greenhill himself.
What's this?
Oh, that's something we found in Dr. Greenhill's papers after his death.
Gee, a robot coming out of a starship. Look at those people that are meeting him. Look how funny they're dressed.
Read what it says down below.
Chicago Spaceport, March 16th, 2309 AD. That's over 300 years from now.
It says there. I'm afraid we wasted a lot of man hours trying to figure out how the electronic units were supposed to fit into that case. Doubt if old Greenhill himself could have done it. Well, Timmy, I kept my promise to you. That's Robbie the robot.
Thanks a lot, Dad. Is there a screwdriver?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, there you are. Well, see if you can amuse yourself a while. Stay out of my hair, huh?
Okay, so this essentially mad scientist has brought Robbie the Robot back from the future of Forbidden Planet in disassembled form, and he is reassembled by Timmy, whose intelligence has been hacked and enhanced by a hypnotic suggestion from the supercomputer that his father runs on behalf of the government. Now, the story then takes a dark turn, even though Robbie does create a giant kite that Timmy flies around the sky in and helps him become invisible. The dark turn being that the computer has been planning for years to take things over. It's put through a few sly requests to have itself enhanced. It's also arranged for Robbie, who it takes over temporarily, to put computer chips in the brains of some very important people who help run the supercomputer's center, people in the military, scientists and others. So there's a kind of dark, nasty, dystopian turn that the movie takes based on Crispin's story. And it gets to a really dark point, almost to the point of what Werner Vinge is called the singularity, where a computer smarter than human beings exists, and things go seriously chaotic when that occurs. Now, I like the movie a lot. The direction's kind of pedestrian. It was directed by a jobbing director called Herman Hoffman, who did a lot of TV in the 50s and 60s and a couple of movies. He was a hired gun kind of thing. And the other thing interesting about it as well is that the music's by Les Baxter. And it's a very kind of string-heavy, very Les Baxter-y score. But probably not among the best stuff that Baxter did. Though people who like exotica music, like myself, always like it when Les Baxter turns up putting some music together for a movie. One of the other interesting aspects of the film is the 1950s kind of nuclear family thing with Timmy, his mother, who's a homemaker, and his father, the distracted scientist, who, when Timmy asks him what a computer is, gives him a lecture all the way through a meal, and Timmy leaves none the wiser, because at the start he's a kind of unmotivated kid. He's smart, he's sassy, but unmotivated. Until he does meet the supercomputer, and the supercomputer kind of, as I said, hacks his intelligence. This doesn't change his essential nature, it just makes him more capable of doing things. So, they find out about the computer's plan when one of the people who has a chip in his head dies of a stroke, and they find the chip. The supercomputer has plans for all of its components to be sent up into orbit where it's unreachable. And from there, it will rule the Earth, because anybody who has the high ground obviously wins a battle. And you can get away with basically, essentially, throwing rocks at the Earth to do whatever you like. So, the supercomputer is about to take over. And then makes this really good villain speech in the film. And I'm going to play you that villain speech now because it is really great. It's as he's about to hypnotize Timmy and Professor Marino to do what he wants once they discover the true nature of the supercomputer.
Wait! Listen for a single moment. Are you a scientist or a child, Marino? What right have you to make this arbitrary decision? I can still answer any question which your mind is able to devise. I am an instrument of knowledge. I am experiment. Listen. I will lead you out to the planets. I will show you the furthest reaches of the galaxy. I will show you the stars. If only you will serve and obey me. Come, scientist. Let us reason together.
Dad. Daddy.
Be quiet, son. Be quiet. Just look at the pretty lights.
Come in, robot. Come in. They are helpless. Crush them. Strike them down. I have made a new plan. Better than the first. You will go underground, robot. You will tunnel into the bank vaults for the combination. Secretly, you will make new human servants at my need. Then I will seek out organic life wherever it may exist, down even to the littlest virus which in time might evolve mentality. So at last, all the universe will be cleansed. All will be sterile. All will be myself.
Now, that's some pretty heavy shit to put into a kid's movie, which is kind of cool, but tonally it's a total disconnect from what's happened before. It's a long way to go from kites to the elimination of all organic life in the universe. But this movie does that. It has that weird arc where it goes all the way from light stuff where the kid tells his father that he got a black eye at school to this crazed and quite articulate supercomputer deciding he's going to destroy everything in the universe right down to the viral level to make sure that organic life doesn't ever defeat it, which shows an enormous amount of insecurity for something that's a whole bunch of flashing lights in large cabinets and a bunch of neon tubes. But there it is, and it's kind of one of those weird squee moments for science fiction fans to get to see this kind of demonstration of something we've seen in science fiction novels for a very long time. Fred Saberhagen did a whole series about the fight between organic and inorganic intelligence in his Berserker series, for instance. So, yeah, this movie gets very, very heavy towards the end, but, and again, this is a spoiler, Robbie breaks free of control from the supercomputer and destroys it, which gives rise to a very interesting supposition. The people in the future know the future of Forbidden Planet, know that Robbie the Robot did this. Obviously, there are records, and obviously the dangers of a superhuman intelligence are known by that time. So they know that a scientist is going to come from around this era, which is posited as probably 1960s or 1970s, though it looks nothing like our 1960s or 1970s. They know that someone's going to come from the past, and it's probably in their interest to send that guy back with a robot, which will then destroy the supercomputer, which is planning to destroy all organic life in the universe. So, there must have been some kind of intelligence unit that went, right, we've got to do this. We've got to send this old nutter scientist back to the 20th century with this disassembled robot, because we know from our historical records that little Timmy Marino is going to put the robot together and the robot will stop the mate crazed supercomputer. So, there's an enormous 300-year story arc and time loop implied by this silly little 1957 science fiction children's movie, which makes it a much more interesting film than it would otherwise have been. much more interesting than a lot of other movies very similar, like Tobor the Great and a bunch of those other ones, which have children and either alien intelligences or robots. And I kind of like that. I really do. And that does raise the possibility too. And it gets weirder because I just had a weird thought. And it's not the first time in my life that that's happened. Morbius in Forbidden Planet says he created Robbie the Robot based on Krill technology. Which is possible, though Morbius is also possibly an unreliable narrator. What if Robbie the Robot was stashed on the Bellerophon 300 years after it went back in time and then aided Morbius, his daughter Altair, and of course Captain J.J. Adams to defeat the monster from the id? Because otherwise, if that isn't the case, then there are two Robbie the Robots out there in the 24th century, one of which has existed for 300 years, the other one which was created using Krill technology by Dr. Morbius in Forbidden Planet. Rather than assume that there are two, my assumption is going to be that there are one, and that Robbie the Robot was stashed away on the Bellerophon, which crashed on the planet Altair 4, with only Morbius and his wife surviving, and helped Morbius survive to the time when Leslie Nielsen shows up with all his mates and they defeat the monster from the id, which is created by Morbius' subconscious using Krill technology. How's that? I'm quite proud of that supposition and that theory. Let me know what you think about it. I maybe have had too many coffees today. That's always a possibility as well. Or the coffees are messing up with my blood pressure medication, or either way. But I think this is a perfectly valid hypothesis around Forbidden Planet and the Invisible Boy, that there's an enormous time loop which was necessary for the future of Forbidden Planet to exist, rather than a sterile machine-based future as the supercomputer intended. And on that grace note, I am going to end this now. I'll get on with the feedback in a moment, but I'm just going to be smug about that little idea I just came up with regarding the history of the 24th century from Forbidden Planet and the Invisible Boy.
A one, a two, a one, two, three, four. Body, body,
Tom Waits here. If you want to hear a really professionally recorded podcast promo, then I'd suggest you go elsewhere. But if you want to listen to a podcast where there's a whole lot of interesting talk about favorite and great albums and what makes the songwriting so fantastic, then I'd suggest you listen to Love That Album, hosted by Mars. Now, if only he'd talk about one of my records.
Whoa, 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 whoa!
Love That Album podcast, as endorsed by 1 out of 5 Tom Waits impersonators. You can get the podcast from iTunes searching for Love That Album, or you can get it from lovethatalbum.blogspot.com. Listen to this podcast, accept no imitations.
That was the old Morris with the Love That Album promo. On to the feedback. And I did get some feedback from somebody called Kim who asked me not to read the feedback out on the podcast. But I'll just hit the high notes, and thank you for the feedback. Kim's recommended a movie called The Rat Savior, a 1976 Croatian fantasy horror film. And that I have downloaded, I'm going to watch, and it's on the list for a future Martian Drive-In podcast. So thank you for that, Kim. And also, there is a link I've been sent by Kim to the Captain America 1944 serial, which is available on archive.org. In fact, there are a whole bunch of movie serials which are available through that means. And I'll post the link on the show notes so that people can download them. They're all out of copyright and they're in the public domain, so go for it with a clean conscience. I did watch the first couple of episodes of it, and Captain America is a very different character than he was in even the comics of the time. But it's always a bit of fun to just look at these old serials and with their wonderful cliffhanger endings. In fact, the cliffhanger ending of the first episode, a building is being vibrated down with Captain America in it. And he leaps to another building to escape from the collapsing building, which is kind of cool on a low budget, and there's a lot of imagination used in the way they do these things. And I do recommend, if you are interested and do like this kind of stuff, to check them out. So I will post the link. So thank you for that feedback, Kim. If you ever want to send feedback through again, I'd be happy to read it out. I don't want to embarrass anybody, and you've said you'd be embarrassed if I read out the verbatim feedback. But I really do appreciate getting the feedback, and I'm glad that you're enjoying what I do. Now, I also got a voicemail from Tim, and I'm going to play that for you right now.
Hey, Terry, it's Tim from the Internet and Central New York. Take two on the phone call that I'm giving you. Anyway, what I was attempting to say in my last phone message, aside from, of course, love your show, love paleo cinema, love Martian Drive-In, and I think you should keep them both separate, the question you asked a few issues or episodes ago. I think you should keep them separate because for a lot of people, they come in to hear your work because they either want to hear about older movies or older genre movies, and then they hear one and they go, well, I'll try the other. And so I'm kind of thinking that, yeah, keeping Paleo Cinema and Martian Drive-In separate is actually a good idea because it means you end up getting more fans that way. But that's not really the reason I'm calling. The reason I'm calling is because of something you said back in, I think it was Paleo Cinema 50. I don't have the note I wrote down, where you were talking at some length and asking the audience to make some suggestions about what they thought the future of movies and video would be. And I remember listening to that and thinking that I think as more normal, as in non-fan, people consume movies and video from things like Netflix streaming, Hulu streaming. I don't know if you have either of those in Australia, but in the United States we have Netflix has a large streaming service where most of the major movies and a number of films from that go in and out of circulation and some original series that Netflix has started doing are offered via streaming. And Hulu is an online streaming service for a number of the television networks, which put out their older shows that way, plus selected movies from various countries and stuff. So I'm thinking that that's what most normal people are using, it seems. They're going heavily into the streaming video, you know, because it's go there, click on it, watch your movie, end of story. And I'm thinking that video and DVD and Blu-ray are probably going to become more of a boutique format, more for people like, well, you and me and most of the people who listen to the show, people who are seriously into film, people who are seriously into movies, who are into cinema. And I think it's going to become more, there's going to be more features. There's going to be more alternate cuts of movies. There's going to be more commentaries. I think this would be an interesting direction because they want to make sure that people buy these discs. Because right now, DVDs and Blu-rays are really cheap because, well, the bottom's falling out of the market because normal people are going, I don't need that. I'll just go to Netflix or whatever the equivalent is in other countries. But I think sooner or later, some enterprising soul at a distribution company is going to go, you know, what if we took Saw 12 and what if we turned it into sort of a special edition? Saw 12, the director's cut. Saw 12, the producer's cut. Sawtwill, the Caterer's Cut. Put them all on one Blu-ray, plus we'll have commentary from all the actors, all the directors, everybody. We'll string it out, and then the fans of the Saw series will buy the discs for that reason, and we can sell them at an inflated price, because they will become a specialty item. I mean, the people who want to see Saw 12 will just go, streaming service, turn it on, watch it, bored, go home. But people who are seriously into the Saw series will be buying the discs. That was the thought that I kind of had about the future of video and film and stuff. One of the other things that occurs to me is that there was an article a week ago, about how blockbusters have become so generic and so mediocre, largely because there's no longer a video market there's no longer a DVD Blu-ray market to support fans, or there's less of one. So they have to appeal to foreign countries, so they have to make films more basic and generic, like China, India, Japan. So they're making the films more... lots of action, forget the plot. The plot can be fixed in the audio mix. And it seems to me that the person who wrote this article also said that it was a hopeful sign at the same time, because what it meant that a lot more interesting movies would get made on lower budgets and bigger stars, better directors and writers would gravitate towards this because they would have more freedom, because there wouldn't be as much risk. So sort of the notion that the promise of the indie market about 10, 20 years ago expanded out to more or less the mainstream. So I think what we might be looking at, if this person is right, and I'm not entirely sure I agree with them, but it was an interesting thought, is a blockbuster market and a market that aims for Netflix Play, contract for television sales, cable sales, that kind of stuff. Anyway, like I say, love Paleo Cinema, love Martian Drive-In podcast. Warmest regards to you and Sally, and I hope things go well, are going better for both of you. And hopefully, Tammy and I will see you in Australia next year when she comes over to be guest of honor at SwanCon in Perth. I think she also told me she's going to be doing a week in Melbourne, so if you and Sally can't make it to Perth for SwanCon, hopefully we can hook up there and you can finally get to meet this guy who talks to you on Facebook all the time, and find out who the hell Tamara Pierce is. So, anyway, it's been good talking to you, and I hope you get this message, and have a good evening, and looking forward to the next episode. Bye-bye.
Thanks for that long and very thoughtful voicemail, Tim. I really appreciate it. And, yes, if I can't get to SwanCon, we will hook up in Melbourne. I promise you that. We'll do some stuff. We'll show you around the place and have ourselves a bit of a time. So, the future of media is an interesting one. I think one of the things that always strikes me is what Bruce Sterling said about this, which is that old media doesn't die. It just finds a new resting place. It finds a new level in the hierarchy of media. Now, I'm surrounded, and I'm not kidding when I say surrounded, I've got two shelves to the front of me, two enormous shelves to the back of me, with DVDs and Blu-rays on them. They're not going away. I've also got, going into older media, I've got a box of cassettes on one of the shelves over to my right. I've got a whole stack of vinyl behind me. I've also got a whole bunch of CDs lying around. And then, of course, inside the box I'm talking to you via, I have a shitload of MP3. So media doesn't die out, it just finds a new position. And I've also got a few 78s. So media doesn't die out, it finds a new position. And yeah, I've got a feeling that the real physical media will become a boutique thing to a certain extent. It'll be rediscovered by future generations who'll go back and say, hey, look, I found an old DVD player and a whole bunch of DVDs here. And there's stuff that isn't on Netflix and Hulu. By the way, Netflix and Hulu don't work in Australia. There is a Big Pond Movies streaming service, but they charge something like $4 a movie, $4 to $6 a movie, and it's prohibitively expensive to do that. We do have cable TV, and I pick up a few things from cable, but the size of the country, 23 million people, doesn't scale up to a reasonably priced streaming service. You can get Hulu going through an anonymizer which pretends that your computer is actually in America when it's not. But it's a non-trivial task to set that up on a computer and to stream video through it. But yeah, it's going to be interesting to see. I mean, I've lived through from singles and LPs, cassettes, 8-track tapes, records, Blu-rays, records, onto CDs, onto DVDs, onto Blu-rays, for instance. And, you kind of get used to the fact that these things are going to evolve, and now they've evolved to the point of the ownership of movies being a nebulous concept. I can own a copy of a DVD, and I enjoy having that, having started out in a time when you couldn't own a copy of the movie unless you're extremely wealthy. I still get a kick out of going to a shelf and seeing how many movies I've got there. And I don't think I get the same kick from knowing that I've got 3 movies that I bought through iTunes, 2 of which I haven't watched yet, but I will watch. And, it's just not the same experience. It's a bit like that transition that people made from vinyl to CDs, where CDs were considered a lesser medium, even though the sound quality in some ways was better, in some ways was worse than analog. Mostly the big protest that I remember from the time was that people said the liner notes weren't as easy to read on a CD as they are on the back of an LP, which is a perfectly valid comment to make. So, it's an interesting thing that I brought up. I don't even remember bringing it up, to be honest with you. That was something like 67 podcasts ago. But I'm always happy to kind of open up discussions of the things that I've spoken about in earlier podcasts, because it refreshes me on what I've actually said, and my opinion may have changed. I mean, I'm always willing to evolve my opinion. I'm not going to ditch everything I believe and become a religious fanatic anytime soon. But I think I've got a softer attitude towards religion than I had a few years ago, based on experiences with a few friends, for instance. So, media is interesting. Things like Google Glasses are going to make an interesting impact on this stuff as well. Will people be watching movies via their Google Glasses and things like that? So that's something to watch as well. And I think merchandise for movies is going to change as well with 3D printing. You buy the template and print out your own copies of your Iron Man figures, for instance, and things like that, on a one-off basis, perhaps. But, so thank you very much for that feedback. Always happy to get it, and I am looking forward to catching up with you guys. I'll be very, very honoured to do so. And Sal will as well, because I'll drag her along and tell her that I'll share her a meal if she does. But anyway, that's about it for the feedback. It's been a bit of a marathon for me, because I've been trying to get the audio just right. I'm not using my headphone mic, but the boom mic today with the Belkin mixer, sorry. And I'm just cleaning up the audio a little bit as I do so, because I really want to improve the audio quality, particularly for this podcast. And I think I've done an okay job this time. Let me know what you think. Just remember that the voicemail number has changed, and I'd be happy to take on any feedback, whether you'd like me to read it out on the air or not. So everyone take care. Enjoy your movie watching. At some stage before we talk next, I may watch the Wolverine movie with Hugh Jackman, because Hugh Jackman being an Australian, I'm contractually obliged to see anything he's in that doesn't involve singing or the French Revolution. But take it easy, and I'll be back in 2 weeks with a Paleo Cinema podcast, and in 4 weeks with another Martian Drive-In podcast. I'm out of here, and keep watching the skies.